Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you the Heretics Hour live on Voice of Reason Network. It is February 13th, 2012. This time, a special day that I care about has fallen smack dab on a Monday, and it's not one of those holidays that are moved to Monday to give everyone a three-day weekend. Today is the 67th anniversary of the destruction of Dresden that took place on February 13th and 14th, 1945. The apocalypse of Dresden, the Holocaust of the citizens of Dresden, along with hundreds of thousands of German refugees fleeing the advance of the Red Army in the East. I think everyone has heard of Dresden because it was the largest single death toll by bombing in World War II. Yes, in my opinion, greater even than in the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, taken singly, where atomic bombs were dropped in August of that same year. It's not just in my opinion, but it is based on facts and figures, and I'll go into that later on in the show. I'm very pleased to have as my guest tonight the well-known blogger, Tan Staffel of the Age of Reason blog. Age of Treason blog. I'm used to saying reason. The Age of Treason blog at blogspot.com. He'll be joining me after I do my reading from The Fire by Jörg Friedrich. And tonight, my reading is from several places in the book where Mr. Friedrich writes about Dresden. So I'm just going to start right in, and then we will discuss all of the other things that we want to say about Dresden after this first half hour. So I'm starting tonight on page... about in the middle of the book, on page, I have to get my reading glasses on page 269. Bomber Command's best squadron was number 5 Bomber Group. In wide area attacks on German cities, their target indicator techniques caused the greatest damages by far. The handiwork of this elite task force was responsible for the firestorms of Kassel, Darmstadt, Brunswick, Heilbronn, Dresden, and Würzburg. The complete incineration of cities did not result from a lack of precision. Quite the contrary, it was a job of absolute precision. Also a part of No. 5 Bomber Group was 617 Squadron, which had been set up for the Dam Busters raid on the Monet Dam. This elite force had tested the accuracy of marking precision targets and was able to transfer the technique to wide areas, such as the area burned precisely within the intended boundaries. Strict control of the different colors of illumination flares by the master bomber was an integral part of this precision, as was the assessment of wind values, which was a constant source of error and joint orientation on a fixed target. Würzburg was not mentioned in the American-British Target Selection Committee until early February 1945. Primary targets at that time were Berlin, Dresden, Chemnitz, Leipzig, Halle, Dessau, Erfurt, and Magdeburg. The bombs were supposed to strike evacuation movements away from the Eastern Front and troop movements toward it. Catch that, evacuation movements away from the Eastern Front. So that was, they were targeting the civilians, refugees. That's murder in my estimation. Alternative objectives included Hildesheim, Würzburg, Forsheim, Worms, and Nuremberg. In the British House of Commons, Conservative Party MP Reginald Purbrick explicitly mentioned Dresden, Freiburg, and Würzburg when he addressed the government on February 7th. with regard to cities that had not yet been bombed, asking when it would be their turn. All right, I am going to move ahead quite a few pages to page 310 for more on Dresden. In early February 1945, there were about 800,000 people living in Dresden, perhaps a million. About 640,000 of them were regular residents. The rest were refugees. The two groups sacrificed a total of 40,000 people on February 13th and 14th, 1945. As I said before, Mr. Herr Friedrich is using conservative figures in this book, and I don't blame him. If he didn't, he would be accused of exaggeration, and his book would be panned, and nobody would read it. So I think he's using the most conservative figures that are acceptable, because I don't think a total of 40,000 people on February 13th and 14th is accurate, particularly when you have about a million people in the city, about half a million refugees who had no real place to live. Now, next to Hamburg, this marked the highest human losses of a German city during the air war. The outcome of the Hamburg mission resulted from, along with Bomber Command's efforts, a rare combination of factors. That July success clearly stands out from the preceding results of the Battle of the Ruhr. The July success he's talking about is Hamburg, bombing of Hamburg, where 40,000 people were killed in one raid. Such a density of destruction exceeded the weapons potential. There had to be an unforeseen booster factor, such as Kassel's firefighting problem due to its isolated location. The Dresden raid was different, which harkened back to Allied plans to carry out a thunderclap in the summer of 1944, a colossal massacre with more than 100,000 casualties. They had been thinking of Berlin. This, in turn, was a moderate version of the gas and germ warfare attack that Churchill had wanted to impose on 60 German cities. Some of this may have been talked about that I haven't read yet. But we know that they had plans to do these huge, to kill 100,000. In this case, they're talking about the plans that Churchill and the Bomber Command made for gas and germ warfare. And they had a plan to impose that on 60 German cities. But other than that, they wanted a colossal thunderclap massacre. Starting in summer 44, they had been hoping for this, that would kill more than 100,000 people in one raid. So they had these huge plans to kill many, many, many people. And I'm pointing this out, I hope I have time to do it, because to think that when they went to Dresden, they really were intending to only bomb the marshalling yards and some transportation centers, which has proved not to be the case anyway. Is totally wrong, because they were wanting to murder as many German civilians, as they could. That's just the way it looks. To continue reading, the 8th Air Force would find out just how hard it is to kill 100,000 people when they hit Berlin with half a thunderclap in February 1945. Instead of the planned 2,000 aircraft, only 937 participated. Instead of 5,000 tons of bombs, only 2,266 were dropped. And they killed only 2,893 civilians instead of the projected 110,000. Even a miserably defended metropolis with totally insufficient air raid facilities resisted total destruction by virtue of its sheer volume. The Allied principle of closed zones of annihilation could be best implemented on areas of under 2 square miles. Small and medium-sized cities with a densely built historical old town were vulnerable to firestorms, and only fire could seal the death zone. The tighter the dimensions, the more complicated the hit accuracy. Number 5 Bomber Group had become expert in precision annihilation, and it led the Dresden mission. The thunderclap was to come to a city so remote and insignificant for the war effort that it had been ignored for 4.5 years. It was a long distance away, but no farther than the Ruhrs, hydrogenation works, where the 8th Air Force had dropped 4,000 tons of bombs, and they had dropped 8,000 tons at the Luna plant still farther west. While Churchill, Eisenhower, Harris, and Portal were writing down thunderclap ideas, Number 5 Group was methodically testing all that could be achieved with the available means. By the fall, this group had forged the Sommer's destruction plans into a murderous weapon. In contrast to Hamburg and Kassel, five-digit casualty figures did not merely come to be, they were created. On September 11th and 12th, 1944, Number 5 Group kindled a firestorm in Stuttgart and another in Darmstadt. Stuttgart was consumed by fire, but its inhabitants were protected thanks to its tunnels. Darmstadt was 75% smaller, but suffered 13 times the human losses. From then on, that became Bomber Command's reference raid. It served as a model for Dresden. Darmstadt was the rehearsal and Dresden the performance. Because the rehearsal stage was so tightly built up, the impact there was more intensive. The rate of annihilation there was 10.7%, more than double that of Dresden. Only Forzheim was bled whiter. The attacks against Darmstadt and Dresden used No. 5's own procedure, the fan. The fan was a quarter of a circle. Its vertex in Darmstadt was at the parade ground. In Dresden, it was at the soccer stadium of the Dresden Sport Club, within the expansive Ostrahenge fields. In both cases, the approach was divided among a number of routes, misleading the aircraft warning center. In Darmstadt, there were 10 minutes between alarm and bombs. In Dresden, 25, but in Dresden, the distances to the shelters were also greater. Darmstadt did not mark the escape routes to the shelters with arrows. Neither of the two cities had bunkers. At 10:03 p.m., the illuminators began to light up the Elbe Valley and the city and with white cascading flares. Now, this is February 13th at night. 2 minutes later, green markers were dropped on the DSC stadium. In Darmstadt, the white parachute flares floated down to the parade ground at 11:35 p.m. The marker aircraft dove down to 3,300 feet, outlining the gleaming bright square first in red and then green. The target indicator went astray to the main train station. The master bomber raced in and annulled the green with yellow as if with a highlighter pen. Then he climbed up and called in his bomber squadrons. Dresden's master bomber swooped down, penetrating the thin cloud cover, and eyed his target. It evidently lacked flak defenses, so the high-flying Lancasters could drop down to 10,000 feet and the visual markers down to 900 feet. The stadium was marked in red. It was 10:13 p.m. After 10 whole minutes of undisturbed illumination and marking, not even a searchlight flashed on. In Darmstadt, too, the plans were being... Back to Dresden. On February 13th in Dresden, the course of events was more routine. It worked in Heilbronn, in Freiburg, and would soon raise Würzburg. The plan would not be delayed at all in Dresden because the plane started with 2,200 gallons of fuel in their tanks and had no reserves. There was a 25-minute window of time from 10:03 p.m. until 10:28 p.m. Then the planes had to begin the 900-mile flight home. The master bomber had first to arrive. The master bomber, the first to arrive, had only 12 minutes once target indication had been completed. Instructions over VHF radio announced, controller to plate rack force, come in and bomb glow of red, TIs as planned. Then the fan opened up. The planes did it. The left leg crossed the bend in the Elbe twice. The right leg ended at the train tracks at the Falkenbrücke overpass. The connecting arc was completed in front of the train station. The quality of the bombing involved covering the entire fan area equally with fire, blast waves, and explosions. Fire was spread like a paste. The master bomber and the marker leader made sure that no gaps remained, that the fires could not close up. It was a matter of the exact angle taken by each plane within the fan and the precise overshoot, the distance between pivot and bomb release. The master bomber's eye was glued to the fan. Hello, plate rack force. Attention. One drop too late. One went down too wide. Good work, plate rack force. That's nice bombing. Hello, plate rack force. The bombing is getting wild now. Pick out the red glow if you can. That was a quote. Mass destruction was precision work, down to the millimeter, and it would not occur if tons of bombs were randomly dropped on a town. A town could cope well with that. Skipping a few paragraphs, I read, the fan of Dresden created the expected firestorm within half an hour after number five's departure. Although the bombs fell slightly off the intended target, the effect was precisely as planned. The group's method kept the fan from spreading out too much. At its wildest point, it was 1.5 miles across. It covered 3/4 of the old town. Owing to the substantial weight of the airplane fuel, only 877 tons of bombs could be loaded, which was exactly the tonnage dropped on Darmstadt. Harris therefore ordered a double attack, which had been tested in Duisburg, Cologne, and Saarbrücken. The double attack did not merely double the devastation, it multiplied it, because it struck just as the people in the city thought the worst was over. 90 minutes after the all-clear, Dresdeners barely had time to drag themselves to the great garden or the wide grassy banks of the Elbe, which they had been instructed to do if in case of a raid like this, before the sirens howled again, this time only in the suburbs. The alarm system in the city were no longer functioning. The double blow reckoned with such defects, it helped increase the human losses. As expected, there was no longer ground visibility when the second attack fleet arrived at 1:16 a.m. The firestorm shot a mile-high cloud of smoke into the air. The old market was nevertheless a designated point target in the middle of the fan. This corresponded to the purpose of the double blow. It delivered a knockout punch. The first attack chased the people into shelters, and the second attack hit those leaving their protection with feelings of relief. The protective effects of cellars was exhausted after 2 hours. After that, under a blazing city district, the basements no longer preserved life. Whoever let themselves be chased back into the cellars during the second attack rarely emerged alive. Those who hid outdoors, like the refugees in Dresden's Great Garden, also failed to survive. The logic of the process was geared toward inescapable mass extermination. When the master bomber saw the situation in the fan below him, he considered it deadly enough and had the area to the side of the quarter circle marked to open the fan wider in both directions, toward the left across the Elbe, which the fire could not jump across, into the new part of the city, and to the right toward the main train station, and into the great garden, an easily recognizable, non-flammable area. The left bank of the Elbe is bordered by a strip of meadow, a third of a mile long. That February, an icy wind was howling across it, and it had started drizzling overnight. The people in cellars near the river hurried to the cooling morass after the first attack of smoke, flying sparks and scorchingly hot air, which were all being sucked toward the brewing firestorm. The nursing staff of the Johann Stadter Hospital carried the patients in their thin striped hospital gowns and laid them down there. Women who had just given birth were running out of the polyclinic. That was the first group that the double blow had lured from their hiding places and now held caught, defenseless. On the other side by the train station was another island of refuge, the expansive Great Garden, a park area with a stand of trees. This was where the second group of Old Town refugees fled. The meadows along the banks of the Elbe and the Great Garden gathered up tens of thousands. They had no other choice. The way the fan was spread, the city geography offered only these two sites. The conflagration area of number five group squeezed the people caught there as if into a bag held open. And that was where a large portion of the munitions of the follow-up attack were pelted down. The main train station was outside this fan. It was packed to the brim with refugees from the Eastern Front. The first raid had left open a chance to shunt a large number of passenger trains out of the city area, which were brought back once number five had completed its work. That made the train station a preferred target for the second blow. Thus, three extermination centers had been established: the cellar landscape below the Old Town conflagration, the grassy areas, and the train station. However, the blazes of number 5, coupled with the double blow method, created only a fraction of the numbers of deaths that the thunderclap bosses had commissioned. I'm skipping a bunch of pages again, running out of time, but I hope to get as much as I can. Residents were instinctually drawn to the basement if something outside exploded, splintered, or burned, but the underground coolness merely postponed the inevitable. The cellar was a cold oven. The burning house block transferred the glowing heat to the cellar stone, where it was stored. Rescue teams could not enter buried cellars for days or even weeks because they remained too hot. If not touched directly by the flames, the fire casualties were mummified, and not until an autopsy was performed could it be determined whether the cause of death was gas, lack of oxygen, or heat. But people wanted to know. In order for a chamber to become an oven, there had to be a draft, a flow of air. After gaining experience from the Castle firestorm in late 1943, Dresden's old-fashioned protection agency started interlinking the cellars under the Old Town with passageways that had been dug out and bricked up under the streets. The cellars and passages created a meshed network. Whereas in Castle, escape to the Fulda River had been blocked, in Dresden, every corridor was supposed to lead either to the Elbe River to the north or to the Great Garden in the south. There were large exit shafts on the Elbe side of the New Market, and at Schlossplatz and Postplatz, the squares at the castle and post office. On the opposite side, toward the main train station, and Weinerstrasse and Leninstrasse, there were no special exits, but any entrance to an apartment building could serve that function. Dresden did not have bunkers. The network of catacombs of the basement cellars provided cover, and the banks of the Elbe and the Great Garden offered cooling and air, but this system failed. The cellars held their occupants tight, and thousands died in them due to the air draft. The corridors under the Old Town served as an entrance and exit. According to the plan, people entered when the bombing started, protecting themselves from fragments, shrapnel, and flames, and left when the bombers withdrew after 30 to 60 minutes. During that time, the cellars remained cool. As the stone gradually started absorbing the heat of the fire, people were supposed to move to the natural escape zones outdoors. The concept failed to consider both the oven-like qualities of the cellars and the behavior of the people who became aware of those qualities. Well, there's a lot here about how these fires started and how things got in the cellars and how bad it was and how agitated the people became. And then some people were leaving. When they went to leave, they got packed. They got caught in these narrow passages. And because of the their lack of oxygen, for one thing, because Germans are usually pretty good about behaving well in groups, but their lack of oxygen caused them to just not know what they were doing, and they started trampling, and sometimes they got packed in there, and nobody could move because they were packed. They were packed like a whatever you call it. They were just stuck. They were stuck, and then they all died. So I'm gonna let this part go. And read the last part that I had marked here. Six days after the February 1945 raid on Dresden, Theodor Elgering, head of the Interministerial Committee on Air War Damages, saw body parts, heads, and arms poking out of the rubble as he monitored the repair work. He joined a young woman's search for her parents. A rescue team lifted the debris from the holes in the cellar walls, and you could literally feel the hot air escaping from the cellar. With a flashlight and guided by the marking arrows, they entered the air raid shelter where the residents of the building were sitting, exactly the way people always sat in air raid cellars, one next to another, on benches, with their so-called air raid luggage beside them. About 30 to 40 people, mostly elderly women and children, were dead, sitting on the benches against the wall. Only a few had fallen to the ground. It was so shocking that the young woman almost collapsed at the sight. Her parents were not there. The family had separated in the network of passengers under the old town because the daughter found the development of smoke to be suspicious. The father had a weak heart and wanted to wait until the smoke died down a bit. The mother wanted to stay with him. The two of them pressured their daughter to fight her way through the billows of smoke to the great garden. They were later found in the back rooms of the cellar in a pile of 108 corpses. This group had wanted to escape the smoke by going to the nearest inner courtyard, but they had trampled one another to death. Russian laborers and prisoners evacuated ditches at Dresden cemeteries to bury 10,000 who had fallen. Then mild pre-spring air came, accelerating the decomposition process. We no longer had any choice, wrote Ellering, but to authorize the incineration of the corpses. They were cremated at the old market, where iron girders were built into huge grates, on which roughly 500 bodies each could be stacked into a funeral pyre, drenched with gasoline, and burned. These funeral pyres at the old, I wasn't watching the time. I will continue finishing this when we come back and introduce my guest, Pam Staffel. Stay with me.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, the U.S. says it's just a matter of time before the Syrian government collapses, while the Pentagon says it's weighing up theoretical military action. Now, although Russia and China are adamant they won't allow foreign intervention in Syria via the U.N., history shows Washington may find a way to bypass diplomatic barriers to push its agenda. RT's Ganesh Chakan explains.
What's in a mandate? Having failed to reach international consensus on Syria,
it's been a complete waste of time.
Washington prepares to act around the UN. For the time being, the administration firmly rules out any form of U.S. military intervention in Syria. But the Pentagon is busy laying out an attack strategy on Syria, just in case, should the president call for action. Experts say history shows the absence of international consensus would not be an obstacle to Washington if it decides to go ahead with intervention.
The United States sees the UN as a tool of convenience. If the UN is supple in going along with the United States, then the United States is fine to have a UN sanction for its actions. But when the UN and the people of the world or the countries of the world resist, then the United States says the UN is unwilling to do its job and then uses other instruments like NATO or other military arrangements. They did that in the case of Yugoslavia. They did that in the case of the Iraq War. Whenever the UN doesn't go along, the U.S. then says, well, to heck with the UN. We'll use some other instrument for the exercise of American power.
Last year, the UN Security Council authorized NATO to protect civilians in Libya, but the mission resulted in regime change.
The Libyan authorization of force was very specific, and it didn't authorize regime change, and the countries that partook in that operation, including the United States, far exceeded the UN mandate in that operation. I think that's symbolic of the fact that these UN mandates really aren't meaningful in the terms of international law. It's just the reality of it.
NATO countries have flooded Libyan rebels with weapons despite a U.N. arms embargo.
The U.S. government wants the U.N., but they want the U.N. to do the U.S. bidding. The way the United States uses the United Nations in regard to the Israeli-Palestinian question is very emblematic. When the United Nations passed resolutions, which it has done repeatedly, demanding that the Israelis get out of the West Bank and earlier Gaza and earlier the Sinai, the United States didn't enforce those resolutions. They didn't demand that they be enforced. When it came to the United Nations saying the Palestinians have a right to be a recognized state, the United States acted as if there was a crime against humanity that the United Nations dared take up the issue of Palestinian rights. We can see here a manipulation of the United Nations. When it does what the United States wants, fine. But when it stands with the Palestinian people, which it has repeatedly over and over again, then the United States government.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm very pleased that my guest tonight is Tan Staffel of the popular Age of Treason blog at ageoftreason.blogspot.com. And you need to put a dash between Age of Treason, age-of-treason. Hello, Tan. How are you?
Hi, Carolyn. I'm very good.
Great. Well, you know, I didn't get to finish all of my reading, but I looked at what I had left, and I think it's okay. I got the point across, so I won't go back to that. But we will discuss Dresden some more tonight. But first, I want to say, I guess I'll just start off by saying, after I asked you to be on the show, I thought, well, I wonder what kind of a name Tan Staffel is. I was thinking it must be a character in an opera or something. I guess I was thinking of Falstaff. So I Google it, and there's a whole Wikipedia page describing what it stands for. I thought that was quite funny.
Yeah, there was a Jewish blogger that really took a hate to me early on that he thought that it was an allusion to Schutzstaffel. That was the first thing that came into his mind, of course, because he had never heard of Tan Staffel.
Yes. So that's kind of neat.
It's an aphorism. It's one of those statements that I picked it before I really was fully formed in my opinions about race and Jews, and it was more of just a general statement of truth that there's no such thing as a free lunch.
That's right. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. That's what it stands for. Very clever. All right. Well, you know, I've been paying attention to the Dresden information or the Dresden numbers and so on for the last few days. So I got kind of drenched in it and trying to find out how the march would go in Dresden, that the right wing parties, the nationalists, always try to do, and they get more and more trouble from it. Today, what I found out was that the nationalists showed up and they had a very nice torch parade, because they start their remembrance there at night, because the bombing took place at night. That's when it started. And the city, I guess, has been criticized for its tendency to want to ignore the whole thing. So this year they had this nice candlelight thing, and everybody was supposed to just calmly come and light a candle in front of maybe it was in front of the Frauenkirche, or was it in front of City Hall? But I've seen some pictures. And then they're going to have a join hands and have a long, I forgot what it's called already, where they, you know, long line of people holding hands with each other. What all that's supposed to be. But see, every time they memorialize the Dresden bombing, it has to be a universalist, pro-peace kind of thing in which German guilt is always, if not spoken about, is assumed and taken into account, and as though, you know, they really deserved it in some way or shape. So these nationalists came and they had their, I saw a picture, they looked very nice. They were dressed in dark clothing, of course, and they all had some kind of a torch. They're all the same. So they go to a lot of trouble to prepare this. And the anti-fascists, as they call themselves, were out. They were more of those than there were of about 1,600 marchers. It was numbered in the paper, and 2,000 of these communists who don't want them to have a right to march. And they created such a disturbance that they had to stop. The police were there, you know, to protect the marchers. They have a right to do it, but they had to stop it before it got to the end. And they led them back to where they started and made the, you know, ended the march. They didn't get to complete their march. And all they do is arrest six or seven of these troublemakers for doing something extremely bad. And the rest of them, they're all just allowed to do that, to stop people from exercising their free speech. It's just such a perfect example of the kind of, I can use the word insanity, but I'd like to get a better word. The kind of
double standard.
Yeah, it's a double standard, and the kind of dictatorial kind of policies that we get, and the kind of lack of any kind of freedom in Germany, which we're seeing here more and more. So, you know, it's a miserable picture. Yeah. But that's what went on there today. So, you know, Dresden was a city of a magnificent Baroque architecture, and it's hard not to talk about the architecture that was destroyed there, and instead of the people. But talking about the people, I have some figures for the numbers. I mean, if you were asked, Tan, how many people died in Dresden, how many civilians were killed, what kind of a figure would you be comfortable saying, you know, knowing whatever it is you know? I don't know how much you know about it.
Before today, I wouldn't have known at all. I would have guessed several thousand. I checked the Wikipedia page earlier today, and I saw that numbers were reported of 200,000, but that's disputed, and it has since been revised down to something like 25,000. But the page was changed since then, so I don't know if they've changed. I haven't read the whole thing now since, but well, it looks like that paragraph is still intact there at the top of the page, toward the top, where it says figures between 200,000 and 500,000. I would believe the higher numbers rather than the lower numbers. I think the lower numbers are a minimization of modern-day revisionism in the opposite direction of our side, where they're trying to revise the numbers down.
Well, yes, they definitely are. And I wouldn't go along with those. I mean, I don't insist on those super high numbers. There seems to be a lot of consensus around the number 135,000 dead. And I'm going to give some sources for that. So I think that's better. But you see how if you just take 100,000, which is not out of bounds, and that how they have to bring it down. They brought it down to 40. Friedrich was using 40. Then they brought it down to 35. Now they've brought it down to 25. And they have all these German historical societies saying that that's the figure that they have studied this for years, and now this is what they understand. This is the true figure, which I think is a part of the effort to World War II deceit and World War II controlling the information, and particularly the Jews just hate the whole idea of Germans being victims. And the easiest place to turn Germans into victims is in Dresden, and so they work very hard to have brought that number down. Now, a girl wrote she wrote a comment in a blog I saw the other day. She said, I've seen her comments before. She's a German citizen. She calls herself Rachel. She said, she found in her ninth grade history textbook, she looked back for it, printed in 1987 in East Germany, and it states that 35,000 people died in the Dresden bombing. So that's what the German textbooks were saying in 1987. Now they would make it 25,000. But, now, I'm going to go over some numbers here, and then when I get done with this, I'm going to want you to talk some more, because I'm not trying to do it all. The Nazis, David Irving's research set the total at 135,000. You know, he wrote a couple of books about Dresden, and his figure is derived from Hans Voigt, who is superintendent of the Dresden Lost Persons Center in 1945. These people were not exaggerating things, trying to propagandize things. They were trying to count the people, you know, what happened in Dresden. But now, here's some more. It was the post 1945 communist mayor of Dresden, Walter Weidauer, who first advanced the much reduced figure of 35,000. I'm reading this wrong. He was the first one to advance the figure of 35,000. He was the communist mayor of Dresden. Well, we know that the communists are also equally against having the Germans be victims. They're really against that. They don't want this equality with the victims of the Soviet Union and the victims of and the people of Germany. So he was downplaying that. But let me go to
Well, you know what makes that so odd is that they're the people who proclaim everyone's equality. Everyone is equal, of course, except for the racists, the Nazis.
That's right. That's right. If you're a right-wing boy, they can't take that. So it's a political battle there. Now, I'm just going to go right down to this good information here. Irving said, well, I don't want to go over that. Great. Here, now, I have a friend. Where is that information from him? I have a friend who is in touch with a, here it is, with a historian living in Dresden. And his name is Jan Horn, this historian. And my friend wrote to him and asked him about it. And he was surprised because he is not a pro National Socialist person at all. But he wrote again and again, I'm surprised how so-called historians are able to falsify history for political reasons. I have to agree with Friedrich Hebbels, H-E-B-B-E-L-S, who was a German novelist and dramatist, when he says there is only one sin committed against mankind and its generation, and that is falsification of history. All right, now, he writes, including the missing, about 250 to 300,000 victims might be a realistic number. I wouldn't go that high, but he is. And he said this number was at that time reported by Colonel of the Police Grosse. That was his last name. On April the 30th, 1945, Lieutenant Colonel Grosse, first general staff officer in Dresden, reported to Führer headquarters that the number of deaths increased to 253,000. I don't think that he would have reported numbers to Führer headquarters that were wildly exaggerated. I don't think that's what they wanted to know. This wasn't going out into the public. This was for the Germans to know what had happened. He says, at that time, 36,000 could be fully identified, 50,000 partly identified by their wedding rings, and 168,000 not at all. Now, this was on April the 30th, so this was, a month and a half after the bombing. So they had time to be, they were, you know, looking into all this. So the majority could not be identified. And most of these numbers are based on how many people were the dead that were identified. He goes on to say the father of the colonel was then administrative chief of the Bau Police. That's the father of this Colonel Gross. He was administrative chief of the Bau Police. That was the police who overlooked the construction business and confirmed his son's numbers. After the war, he was still department chief in Dresden. After 1945, many ten thousands of corpses were recovered. According to secured reports of the Dresden police, 202,000 dead, primarily women and children, were recovered up until March 20th, 1945. Only 30% could be identified. Now, this is not far-fetched. And this is the big problem, is that so many could not be identified. They were totally disfigured and everything was destroyed of them. So they didn't get counted. So while there could be that high of a number, I wouldn't, though, try to push that high of a number, but I certainly am now convinced that I should say 100 to 135 deaths. And they are just doing, they're falsifying history. They're doing damage to history, as they've always been doing, with these low numbers that they're pushing. So that's what I want the people to know tonight.
Yeah. And the double standard is that they can attack, your numbers and say that they're supposed to be lower, that they were only exaggerated because you're just trying to get sympathy. But if you turn that argument around and say that about the Holocaust, that means you're a horrible person.
Exactly. And they're in control, you know, because they're in control. They can say all this. But we have to say it wherever we get the chance. So I want people to understand that there's a lot of bases. There are some other people. I'm not going to take the time to go into it, but there's, besides Hans Voigt, there's Klaus Meinert, who was the city commandant. He suggested 140,000 as Professor Fetcher. And he was an extreme left-wing director of the civil defense of the city in 1945, I suppose maybe after the war. He thought it was 180,000 at that time. And there was a Carl Bodenschatz, who was Hermann Göring's chief minister in his minister department, his minister's ministry, who visited Dresden a few days after the raids and spoke in captivity of 150,000. But anyway, it was a huge number because there were three raids. And as I was reading, you know, the first raid came over. There were 360 heavy bombers. 400. It was, 400 and some planes. But some, not all of them managed to hit Dresden. Some of them hit other things. And then they came back again, in 3 hours. And then the next day, the Americans came. You know, the Americans came in the daytime around noon, at one time there was, about 2,100 aircraft over Saxony on the 14th dropping bombs. So, you know, the people who survived one got hit in the next one. If they survived that one, then they got hit in the third one.
Do you know what the population was of the areas that were destroyed before they were destroyed? Do you have any round figures on that?
I do, if I can find them. The population of Dresden, I think I said it. Now, where was that? There was about a million. There was about 600 and some thousand people living in Dresden. And then there was up to 500,000 refugees in the city. And they downplay those numbers, too, but that's what they say. It was just packed.
Right. Even on the high end of the estimates, it's still only a fraction of what the total population was.
Exactly. Say,
unlike the Holocaust narrative, where the number 6 million is really close to estimates of how many Jews there were in all of Europe. The Germans never even killed all the Jews that they had under their control in hand, much less all of the Jews of Europe. And yet this 6 million number is considered sacred. You're not allowed to question it.
You know, the Jews have taken the word Holocaust to be specifically for themselves. And so they will do everything in their power, and they have quite a lot of power, to keep this Dresden thing down from reaching any kind of proportions where the people would have sympathy for the Germans because call it a Holocaust. But that it was a Holocaust.
Yeah.
Germany, the whole bombing of Germany, once they perfected or got going with their firebombing and creating these firestorms, it was a Holocaust of Germans. So there's no question about it, but you can't say that. And the Germans go along with them to just stomp that out.
Yeah, you said that in one of your earlier programs when you were reading from the fire about how the irony of how it was actually German civilians that were gassed in their cellars in the firebombing, and that's true.
Yeah, a lot of them died from sometimes they had, I was reading, they had coal or coke down in the cellars, and they didn't know that the heat would get so high that they would that it would cause that coke to start gasifying, and they would die. They would be gassed from this stuff, and they had also were gassed from just the kind of fumes that were created in these firestorms. I guess the kind of things that were burning and so on. So it was just, and the pictures. Oh, the pictures! I have seen some pictures and some new pictures that I hadn't seen before, are just horrendous. And if you would show those pictures around, like they show their Holocaust bodies around, people would be just they would be shocked.
Yes, pictures are very effective.
Yeah,
as are films.
And talking about yes, and of course we don't have any of that. Talking about the temperatures, the temperatures, supposedly this German group was saying that, I'll find it here. I'll just look at the email. That the temperatures got up to 2,000 centigrade is that the right word for Celsius? Celsius or
they're equivalent, they're the same thing.
2,000, which cremation numbers are at 800 C. Oh. Not Fahrenheit. This is centigrade or Celsius, which I think
right.
is
well at that temperature. Yeah, 800. It makes for a little
800. Bit. You cremate somebody, and the temperatures in the Dresden fires got up to 2,000. What do you think? I mean, some people were kind of evaporated. Some people's bodies kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
If they were in the greatest heat. And of course, I've read I think other people have too, have paid any attention to it, that even when they, because of the kind of phosphorus and so on, even when they jumped into the Elbe River, they kept burning. So water doesn't put out that kind of burning. So, people were just absolutely burnt to a crisp. It was hideous. Once you're dead, it's not so, but so there was so much suffering going on that people were.
Yes. And the fear,
the trauma of seeing all that going on and being so hot. Ugh.
Well, sitting in a cellar and hearing the timber snapping above you the heat, feeling the heat constantly increasing.
Yeah.
You could contemplate your end for a long time there before it actually came.
And the English, this goes a little beyond the pale. We're talking, using the word success all the time. You know, the worse that was done, the greater the success in their eyes. They had lost all sense of humanity in these plans that they were making. And there's no question about that. They didn't think they needed to have any. They just justified it to themselves somehow, and these things I read about, it shocks me, and I can't be too shocked anymore. But when they said they wanted to have these thunderclaps with, kill 100,000 at a time, wouldn't you kind of shake your head and say, what am I thinking here?
Yeah, well, and this goes back to, Churchill had this plan since World War I. to send 1,000 planes at Berlin and bomb people.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I read
that. Before there was any concentration camps or the poor Jews were mistreated.
That's right. It wasn't about that. They didn't even know about that. It wasn't ever about that. But we don't have too much time in this segment. And then we'll go into some other things. It just shows how absolutely insane and upside down, opposite of everything is what we're living in and what we read about. If we could get, when you compare it with something that's sincere and truthful, it's just so shocking how far out crazy, our information is. And people believe it. People are, they go around believing it because, That's a good thing to discuss, why people are believing. But I've talked about that so much on this show, and I really don't want to talk about that tonight. But, the other thing before I can say is that, Martin Gluck, who is the, he is the head of, gosh darn it, he is the head of a, in Dresden of the Jewish group or whatever, and he was interviewed, and he said we call locally and regionally to spoil the day for the Nazis, and he said that Dresden is they wanted to have a Tatarspuren, tracks of perpetrators walk. I mean, these people actually want to on February 13th and 14th, in order to counteract the sympathy and the memorialization of these bombing raids, they want to do these things that will make Dresden be guilty, and also there are a bunch of posters that they put up. This is what I forgot to say, where they say superstar Bomber Harris superstar. Thank you for what you did, and things like my friend in Germany told me about these, and he sent them to me, so I saw them. They do have these things, and they march and they carry banners that say, "Better to have a bomb on the head than a trip to Auschwitz," and real hateful things. about the Germans, and no sympathy whatsoever.
They have no sense of decency, even by their own standards. The way they demand to be treated, they are incapable of treating other people the same way.
Well, they are. They must be. I mean, they're like little monsters. And they break the law, and they're not arrested. Yeah, big monsters. But it's really amazing. All right. Well, thanks for sticking with me with all that, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you got some information there. And when we come back, I will give Tan a better chance to talk about some.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, says the UN Security Council's inaction on Syria is emboldening the government in Damascus to make an all-out assault on the country's opposition. She was speaking at the start of a General Assembly debate on Syria, prompted by an Arab League proposal to send a joint UN-Arab peacekeeping mission to the country. She said more than 5,000 civilians have already died in Syria, suspects that crimes against humanity may have been committed there, and told the General Assembly that the situation in the city of Homs is deteriorating rapidly.
Reports indicate that hospitals, which were already struggling to cope with all those injured in recent weeks, are now overwhelmed. People have set up makeshift clinics throughout the beleaguered city. Medical supplies have been depleted. Shells have struck at least 3 of these makeshift clinics, resulting in casualties.
Syria's ambassador to the United Nations denied the accusations and accused the UN of being involved in an international plot against his country. Britain's foreign secretary has condemned Monday's attacks on Israeli embassy staff in the capitals of India and Georgia. William Hague has called on officials in New Delhi and Tbilisi to begin investigations into the failed bombings that targeted diplomatic vehicles, injuring 4 people. Nina Maria Potts reports from FSN's London Bureau.
In a written statement, William Hague said he was shocked and appalled to hear of the Monday attacks on Israeli diplomat vehicles, calling on the Indian and Georgian governments to hunt down those responsible for the, quote, deliberate attacks, and offering his deepest sympathies to those injured and their families. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already accused Iran and its Lebanese ally Hezbollah of involvement, amid suspicions that terrorist fighters loyal to Iran are retaliating against alleged Western attacks on Iran's nuclear empowerment. Nina Maria Potts, London.
The European Commission has praised the Greek Parliament for approving the country's new austerity measures in order to receive 130 billion euros in bailout money. The EU's Economics Commissioner, Olli Rehn, says the measures must be implemented in full, despite rising protests against the plan on the streets of Athens. Trade unions and other activists say they will continue to demonstrate against the austerity plan, which will reduce minimum wage in Greece by 20% and cut 15,000 public sector jobs. George Hasiotis is a lawyer who participated in Sunday's protests. He says Parliament is losing public credibility.
They are despised and hated, really. I'm sorry to say that. And I'm also sorry to say, because I am a person of the left, although I'm not a member of any party, that they are not up to the challenge either.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm here with Tan Staffel of Age of Treason blog. And I have one more thing, Tan, to say about Dresden that I just found. I don't want to forget it. And that is this memorial to the 55,000 airmen of Bomber Command that the English have erected. A very large thing. It's a big colonnade of pillars, and it's an entrance to Green Park close to Buckingham. I mean, it functions that way, Buckingham Palace. And then they're going to have some statues, 9 foot tall statues of pilots, some individual pilots in there. I don't know what else. Anyway, I'm not saying it isn't attractive, but the mayor of Dresden in September 2010 went to England. She went to London for some other purpose, but she also made it a point to ask and say to them publicly, please don't build this. It was still in the planning stages. Please don't go ahead with this because the people of Germany are offended by this, and this is harms our reconciliation process. But they were polite to her, and they thought about it, but then they decided to go ahead. And the people of Britain probably, while some would disagree, most of them were for it and wanted to honor their pilots who died. But here's the kind of thinking that they have. This is nothing to do with reconciliation. Here's B.G. Singer. I don't follow B.G.'s, but it's a singing group, probably a little old. But B.G. Singer, Robin Gibb, it was a key supporter of this memorial project. And he said, anyone speaking against it should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. The whole world, including Germany, is free today because of Bomber Command's sacrifice. Can you believe such a stupid statement? This is either up, either completed now, or I saw a story just the other day that they're still completing the statues. So it's not completed yet, but it's pretty much completed. And then, the other thing is that in Dresden, there is no memorial, as I mentioned in my announcement. There is no memorial except this thing, a kind of a plain thing in the cemetery where a lot of the people were buried in mass graves. And it has columns there, not very attractive ones, but, and one of them says Coventry. And another one says Theresienstadt, which was a camp for the Jews. It's supposed to be the Jewish, fancy, nice concentration camp, but, and I don't know what the others say.
That's where the Danish Jews were sent, wasn't it?
Well, the high level artistic, middle class Jews were sent there. It was supposed to be kind of a show how well the Jews could do if they were all to themselves, and the Germans wanted to give them that opportunity. So probably a lot of the Danish were sent there. But
yeah,
anyway, this is not really a memorial to the Dresdeners. They cannot bring themselves to speak for themselves and about their own suffering and what they've gone through. But everybody else can. You mentioned the Poles and the Russians and so on. And they should. Yeah. The thing is, it's the German government, the Germans themselves, that won't allow any memorializing of anything to do with people who were under the Third Reich. That's what it is.
Yeah, they realized, too, that they'd be tortured by international opinion, though, if the German government were to take a strong stand against either for a memorial in Dresden or against the British memorializing their war dead, which I agree with you is a perfectly natural patriotic instinct to memorialize your soldiers, your military men.
Yeah, well, exactly, and this is what's wrong with Germany today, is that Germans can't do that. So I would like to move on here a little bit. You said something the last time you were on VOR that I re-listened to those programs, and you say this often, but it just sums everything up. But you said the conspiracy the conspiracy of the Jews is like someone was, when you were being asked, well, what is the Jewish conspiracy? You say the conspiracy is what's good for the Jews. And I, you say that a lot, and you're really pushing on that, that everything to do with the Jews, everything that, that they're up to is all based on what's good for the Jews. That makes it very simple to understand.
Yeah.
And it's true.
These thoughts have been gelling for a while now, but I think that's at the root of it, that they have a that is the basis of their morality, that things are good if they're good for the Jews and they're bad if they're bad for the Jews. Murder, for instance, you know, most of us, most white folk would think murder is bad, period. There's no extenuating circumstances. And maybe we could think of a few that in our personal condition we might excuse ourselves, but society, as white society as a whole, wouldn't excuse. They'd still throw us in jail for murder. Well, you know, but then there's the Mossad, who will send a team into Abu Dhabi and assassinate a Palestinian leader, you know, because they convince themselves that that fella is bad for the Jews. And the Jews as a whole don't condemn them for it. And the world as a whole has not condemned them, certainly not in the same terms they would if any other intelligence agency, like what happened when bin Laden was assassinated. There was condemnation from around the world that this was murder. But the Mossad thing, it very quickly blew over, even though there was other things that happened, the fact that forged English or British passports and so forth.
Well, when Jewish power is pretty much controlling over most parts of the world, and the way Jews think is what's good for the Jews, and all we're going to have is what's good for the Jews. We're not going to have what's good for us.
Yeah, and it's more than just a direct application of Jewish power. It's this narrative, which I wrote about just recently, the Jewish narrative, when they can get other people's heads full of the same idea, what's good for the Jews, then they have effectively created robots to do their bidding for them. And a lot of these people don't maybe consciously think well, what they're doing is good for the Jews. But one of the statements you said about Dresden earlier about somebody was saying, that thank God for Bomber Harris. You know, he saved us all from...
Yeah, that Bee Gees.
You know, that's how they... that's a very Jewish thing, is to take their particular concerns, where they know if they talked about it in very particularist terms, about it only being about the Jews, which they do plenty of, but they also tend to generalize it and talk about America's interests or everyone's interests. And so they conflate their own interests with a larger group of people. And get everybody thinking. Iran is a good example. You know, we have to bomb Iran. Why do we have to bomb Iran? Well, some Jews will be flat out about it, that we've got to bomb Iran because otherwise they're going to wipe Israel off the map. They're going to kill a whole bunch of Jews. Charles Krauthammer was saying just recently that it was going to be to prevent a second Holocaust. The Israelis are justified in bombing Iran. So he said flat out, basically, in order to prevent the deaths of Jews, a bunch of Iranians have got to die. And the reality, of course, is that it's actually Americans that they want to go and fly those missions and to bomb and start a war and then possibly invade and have our ships sunk. It's going to be American boys who will die. And they make us think a whole bunch of other Jews are writing columns in U.S. papers and going on television telling us how it's in America's national interests to do this. That Iran has missiles and that they are going to bomb Europe and they're going to bomb America and they just hate us. And it's an attempt to broaden Jewish interests and conflate them with other people who then they want to go do their dirty work for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that most people would go along with some idea that Iran is going to bomb the United States. I mean, we know there's no evidence. They've never done anything like that, and they wouldn't be interested in doing that. So the only thing that they're interested in is in the Middle East. And so the Jews are really very weak in that position. And I don't see why, that's why they don't get a lot of support for it. There is not really any support, but their control of the media is what keeps it going and keeps it being talked about. But also our politicians, well, this has been said too so many times, but it is unbelievable how they say we must protect Israel no matter what. What is this business? Yes. This is the same thing that white people have, although I don't think these are their reasons, but their motives. But white people have that, you know, we are the strongest ones. We are the most competent. So we need to take care of all the incompetent ones, but not say that they're incompetent, you know, but just do it anyway. This is what they're basing all this on. And we really can't take care of all these people. And, you know, the Israelis, they're not that competent. If they're left all on their own without getting all that help from the United States, all that money, and from Germany too, they're getting another submarine from Germany. It just makes you sick to think about it. You know, nuclear submarine. If they weren't getting all that stuff, and then they'd have their crime rings all over the world where they bring in trillions of dollars in all kinds of criminal activities. And if they didn't have that, they wouldn't be doing anything. They wouldn't be a threat to anybody.
Yeah, and enabling all of this is this Jewish version of history and the Jewish narrative.
Yeah, and so their whole talent lies in this cunning, scheming, trickery that they do, which has always been a part of what they do. I mean, it goes back into history. They look for their advantage. And so, as you say, it's what's good for the Jews. And they learned that a long time ago. They've never had any reason to change it, and they keep following it.
Yeah, and what's good for X is the natural, normal best strategy for group X. It's just Jews excel at it.
Well, why have we lost this idea what's good for us? Can you have, you know, you've written this blog, your latest blog, A White Guide to the Jewish Narrative. And it's very good. You've got tons of comments after it. I read it all. I liked it. So what would you say about that? About why we don't think about what's good for us. Do we think we don't need to?
It didn't just happen spontaneously. We didn't just decide to stop thinking about us. It was pathologized, and literally it was, you know, turned into some sort of psychological problem. If white people were to think of white people and what's good for white people, this is a sign that you're morally or mentally defective in some way. And it's the other half of the Jewish narrative. You know, the fact that the Jews have been, that part of their story is that they've been victims the whole time. The other half of the story is white people have been the victimizers. We're the oppressors. And that is what people have in mind, like Barry Gibb when he said, or whoever that Gibb brother was, when he said, oh, we're so thankful, you know, because what would have happened if the Germans had taken over the world? It would have been terrible. Well, I can tell you one thing. If the Germans had taken over Europe, never mind the world, there wouldn't be a bunch of Pakistanis taking over Britain right now.
Absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely.
That's the strange thing. When you compare the poor fellows who went and fought and died to keep Britain free of the Nazis, you know, we can't have those darn Germans controlling England, is what they were thinking, so that 7 decades later, we can hand it over to a bunch of North Africans and Egyptians and Chinese and Pakistanis and anybody else who can get here. It's crazy. It's insane.
You know, they should be what the British should be doing, but they don't have the nerve to do it. They should be going to the grave of Winston Churchill. Yeah, we've got a caller in just a second. They should be going to his grave and pulling him out and hanging him up, or they should be going to all these monuments of him and throwing red paint all over him or something. I mean, you know, this guy did more damage, and we have the same kind of people here, but he's such a perfect example of somebody who just did in his own people so badly. Tan, we have a caller. Let's let the caller identify himself, please.
Hello, Carolyn. This is Rodney Martin calling.
Well, hi, Rodney. Nice to talk to you.
I'm really enjoying your program, and I have to say that I believe that you are the only broadcaster that has even mentioned Dresden today, and that's a sad testament to Western civilization. And I just wanted to, I know you're kind of moving on from Dresden, but I wanted to just make a brief comment, if I may,
sure,
about Dresden that often goes outside of the narrative. One real briefly is that, you know, there are, and it makes the mainstream media every year around August. Hiroshima is widely commemorated, and there's a lot of self-loathing in the United States, and that's widely accepted as a, and there's a lot of debate, and that's widely accepted as a war crime. Hiroshima was a city that, very much like Dresden, had no military value. It was a cultural city, and it was used to test a nuclear device, and the, you know, the resulting, you know, the result was catastrophic. And then you use Dresden. Dresden was much more sinister in that beginning in late 42, early 43, the British, and with the Americans, you know, colluding, you know, and people have to understand that even though the Brits were, you know, basically out of that war on their feet, and the Americans, you know, came in and saved the British and saved the communists, saved international communism, the fact of the matter is the Brits consistently wagged the tail of the American dog from the very beginning. And that's why I really shed no tears for what's happening in England today, because they were on the wrong side of history, and they're paying for it. But the British made the decision to engage in something in late 42 throughout the war, that they would target German cities. They engaged in some scientific analysis that if they were to hit the middle of these ancient cities, they even were able to project, you know, these fires and how bad they would burn. And their theory was that they would break the will of the German people to fight, and that there would be some sort of, the Third Reich would collapse. Well, it was wrong, and there was debate inside of England that would not work. That it would, the opposite would you know, the opposite effect.
Mm-hmm, because they knew that what had happened at the German bombing of their cities, which weren't all that much, but compared.
Well,
but
they knew
that it made
England,
the people, it made the people, well, I don't want to get into that, but it made the people resist even stronger. It pulled the people together. But they thought the Germans didn't have the fiber that the British had, and that the Germans would just fall apart at it, which didn't happen. Do you have a question would you like to address something to Tanstaffel?
Yeah, I think that's not necessarily a question, but you know, the fact that that had failed all the way up here, the war was, you know, winding down by the time Dresden was hit, and the fact that here was the last remaining pristine city, and there was a conscious decision made. Well, here's a city that has not been hit. It's a cultural city. There is no military installations around it, and so, you know, further evidence as to the death toll, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees from Silesia that had moved into Dresden fleeing the Red Army. And the fact that that should be something that should be more widely discussed, the fact that late in the war, a Western so-called Christian nation, as Churchill described himself in the British Empire, chose to take that action is just absolutely an abomination. And that is never discussed anymore. And
well,
think,
it's starting to be. Churchill's reputation is really getting tarnished in a lot of quarters. He's taking a lot of criticism now. Finally, he was almost like a god, you know. But there is a lot of British who they're now concerned, like right wing British, who are now concerned with the British morale and not being taken over by the Third World, like Tanstaffel was mentioning. And so they want to use Churchill as the guy, you know, as a strong British white guy who, you know, we should look to. They're in a dilemma there because of what's happened. But this is what happens when you're not honest about things. Your dishonesty gets you all tripped up into all kinds of problems. And that's what's going on in Britain and just about everywhere.
Why people, Carolyn, have to take our kids back, and that means we have to refuse to participate in what's called public education. We have to take our children back, and educate them ourselves and educate them on what's real history versus, you know, fact versus fiction, that is would be a tremendous first step.
I agree with you. Thank you for the call, Rodney.
Join the show, Karen.
I'm glad. I'm glad you called in. I want to let my guest talk a little bit more about where he was, what he was heading into. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rodney. Yeah, about what Rodney had to say, there's the Jewish narrative is why we hear people compared today to Hitler rather than to Tojo, and why when they want to call somebody a bad name, they call him a Nazi rather than calling him a Jap. And it's why we focus on the Holocaust, or why the media focuses on the Holocaust rather than the Bataan Death March, and why the focus is on Europe, the war in Europe, rather than the war in the Pacific. Those differences are all explained by the Jewish influence and control over the media, how they've made their narrative our narrative now.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's all depends on what the Jews want. The Jews don't want to talk about the Japanese anymore, and I'm not saying that we should. But that's all over and forgiven and done with, but Germany is not, and they won't let that go, and they'll never let it go. They'll never let it go because Adolf Hitler was the last leader who actually expelled Jews from his country. And we know they've been expelled by many leaders many times in history. But he was the last one, and they won't forgive that, and they want to make that into a crime. That's what the Holocaust does for them. It makes deporting Jews something horrible, like what this Holocaust was supposed to be. I mean, whereas the only answer to Jewish to what we're talking about here with this Jewish narrative and what's good for the Jews is to either get them out of your country or take away all their power in your country so that they don't run things according to what's good for the Jews, right?
Yeah.
This is so obvious.
And we can't get ahead of ourselves because we're in no position to even set up a country, even if we wanted to move to one on our own, some island somewhere, and exclude Jews. We probably wouldn't have the ability to do that. It's really even simpler. It's even recognizing that Jews are not us is what drives them up a wall. And it's really bizarre, considering the fact that Jews arrogate the same exclusion for themselves. They don't consider themselves us.
I mean, I know.
It sounds nonsensical, but
is that thing, is that they can say they are different from everyone else and they're not us, but we can't say they're not us.
Right.
We can't do anything. I'm screaming again. If we were really under Jewish control, we would not be able to say much of anything. I mean, there would be nothing we could say without getting permission from them. This is the way they are. They're just not able to enforce it to that degree.
They're working on it, with their hate speech laws, and I'm sure that they'll institute it retroactively as well. So they'll go back into the archives that the internet makes possible and make sure that they round up everyone who violated their laws, as was done at Nuremberg.
And I think that people who are partly Jewish can they're still partly non-Jewish, and I think, and of course, I know that you've talked about your wife is part Jewish, but it wasn't anything that you thought about at the time of your marriage. But she seems to be a very good wife, and therefore your children are part Jewish. But people who are part Jewish and then assimilate more and more can just kind of go away. It becomes less and less meaningful. And then they're part of the white race, at least well enough, to function and be a good part of it. So I think when we talk about Jews, I really am anti-Jewish. I am because of what they do, and what they've done to people that I care about, which is the Germans. But at the same time, I don't think that I don't go to that extreme that if anybody has any Jewish at all in them that marks them as somebody who has to go or doesn't belong.
Well, even the National Socialists in Germany didn't.
That's right.
At a certain point, they let it go. because they weren't purists. They weren't one drop.
No, and they even had there were even 100% Jews who were good Germans, and they valued them, and they they were in the army and other places too in the society. So that weren't that many, but there were they did recognize them.
Well, I think it's a two-part problem here, or the nature of Jewishness is like the nature of whiteness. And I hear the music.
Yes. Okay, when we get back, we'll talk about the nature of Jewishness like the nature of whiteness. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We have another half hour to go. Be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Approving the cuts has been, to say the least, I think, painful for Greece. Surely implementing them is going to be even tougher.
It is, but the pain is already there, because after all, this is not the first time that Greece has been asked to cut spending. It's been cutting spending now for 18 months, and in that period, it's fair to say that the Greek economy has entered a death spiral. In other words, there has been an economic collapse in Greece. When the first plan was mooted 18 months ago, the EU and the IMF suggested that the economy might contract by 3%. Well, in fact, it's contracted by 6% in the last year. Unemployment has gone up to 20%. 60,000 small businesses have gone out of business since the summer. So we are watching an economy now in free fall. And certainly, if the new measures which have just been voted are implemented, then that free fall will continue. And this isn't just a matter of figures, percentages and fractions of GDP and so on. This is people's livelihoods. People are going out of business. People are going hungry. Pensioners will not have enough to live off. This is a very, very dangerous situation in Greece at the moment.
How is that free fall, plus what you said about the people who are actually suffering and what we've been seeing in Athens over the past 24 hours, not enough to change the government's mind? And if it's not, what is?
Elections. This Greek thing has been going on now, as we know, for 2 years. There have been cliffhangers almost constantly now for 6 months on this latest package. The fact is that Greece is, as it were, under administration at the moment. It has a so-called technocratic prime minister, a former employee of Goldman Sachs, a man who used to work for the European Central Bank. He is the epitome of an international bureaucrat and banker. But this situation is a transitional one, and there are to be elections in April. Now, you said in your introduction, 199 MPs voted for this out of 300. That means there are already 100 MPs in the Parliament who are against this. The Parliament previously, as you know, returned a socialist Prime Minister, a socialist government under the leadership of George Papandreou. That party, the PASOK Socialist Party, is now at 8% in the polls. So it seems to me pretty certain that by the time an election is held in April, the political landscape will change radically. We already see the extreme left and the extreme right on the rise in Greece. They're the only parties left who protest against this destruction of the country's national sovereignty. And I think it's almost certain that they will greatly increase their votes, if not possibly even take power by the spring.
Right, but before those elections and before April, there's another deadline to get this next bailout.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My guest is Tan Staffel of the blog Age of Treason at blogspot.com. You need to, if you haven't been to that blog, which probably most of you have, you really need to go there. And his current latest blog that he's written that's been very popular is A White Guide to the Jewish Narrative, and we've been discussing that. I want to tell you that the call-in number is 1-855-477-2283 if you would like to direct a question or a comment to my guest. I would appreciate if you'd do that. Now, we were talking about the white, what was that, the white and the Jewish difference?
The similarity between the similarity. Whiteness and Jewishness.
Yeah. Okay.
But in that I see it is two halves. There's a biological half and there's an ideological half. And to be fully Jewish, well, first, the physical personality traits are there. I can see them in my own wife, even though she's only half Jewish. I see the same personality traits that I encounter when I debate and argue with the Jews online. The other side of it, she's not anti-white, though. The anti-white part comes from their narrative, where they teach their children that they are an oppressed people, that they've been oppressed for their whole history, that they've been persecuted for no reason whatsoever, and that the horrible people who have been doing this for the last 2,000 years are Europeans, white people. And so they are the ones who set up this adversarial relationship. I think most white people, to our detriment, think of Jews as part of us and are willing to accept Jews as part of us. Mm-hmm. Think at the very least biologically they're Caucasian. They're on the periphery of European. Although recent DNA studies have shown them to be the Ashkenazi subpopulation, to be fairly inbred amongst themselves, much more inbred than your typical European or typical American. And that they have, it's Middle Eastern, that they're more related to their own Sephardic cousins than to who they've been separated from for a long time. But the whiteness is very similar. You know, you can't be white unless you have European blood. But then we see the consequences of what happens when we lose the other half, the ideological half, which we haven't had for decades now. It was under attack even before World War II in America. I forget the fellow's name now, but the anthropologist, the Jewish anthropologist.
Boaz?
Boaz, that's who I'm thinking of, and the whole team of Jews around him. And mm-hmm. Certainly in the wake of World War II, the attack on white racialism, white racial identity. And to the point today where most white people think, oh, well, what is white? You know, who's white? Are Greeks white? I don't know. Are Slavs white? And it's all so confusing. And you know, who could possibly agree?
Yeah, and you're going to hurt, and you're going to offend people. You're going to offend people.
Yeah, and you might
offend somebody.
You
would never draw any boundaries.
Right. And so the conclusion is, because it's we argue about it, therefore it must be completely invalid to even talk about it, and so let's not talk about it. And besides, white people, and this is a sort of dual thinking, white people are monstrous. I mean, look at all the monstrous things we've done to other people. This is now the Jewish narrative again, and the minority narrative that they've generalized it to. You know, we've gassed the Jews, we've enslaved the Africans, we've stolen the land from the Amerindians and killed them. You know, we deserve payback for all of that. So, you know, simultaneously saying, what is white? Who cares what white is? And at the same time, holding us responsible because we're white.
That's right.
For those things. So it's a dual way of thinking of things. And once you realize that, you realize that it's all a bunch of nonsense, or it's a deliberate demonization of us.
Deliberate. I think the way you're describing this, it has to be deliberate confusing the minds of whites so they can't think straight in their own interests about any of this.
It's deliberate because the first like I did when I first started to question Jews, is I thought to myself, well, these Jews, they're always lecturing us about, you know, what's okay to do, what's not okay to do. It's stereotyping and scapegoating are big themes of theirs, that, saying nasty things about whole groups of people is just unacceptable. Well, it turns out when you examine closely, and I'm certainly prepared today to say this after several years of studying this, that it's really just a trick. They couch things in universalistic terms to appeal, in order to appeal to white folk and get them feeling guilty about these things. But they really have no, they don't actually feel themselves as part of us. And so when they're preaching this, it's for the benefit of themselves. When a school teacher, and I agree with Rodney, you know, one good thing would be to take our kids back from the schools. My kid came home the other day and told me a story about how the teacher told him about the Holocaust and World War II and how horrible it was. Now, my kid is clued in. I've already inoculated him against this stuff. So he understood, and he related the story to me. And we both know that this teacher of his is Jewish. And so when he was telling this sob story, I said, now, you know, you keep in mind, this fellow's, when he's telling you we did these horrible things, he's saying we, as in you goyim, you Gentiles, you're the ones who did this to my people. And he's, basically expressing horror at what was done to his own people. But he's, you know, we try to interpret things in a universalist sense. I think that's partly biological. It has to do with our outbreeding, the fact that we, as Europeans, are less inbred than Jews. We have less tribal loyalty. We are more universalist thinking. We tend to think that way, which is not to say that we're doomed because of that, but we need to compensate for it.
Well, it's a weakness when we have people using it against us. You know, otherwise it's not. When we didn't have people using it against us, it was very nice. You know, we were very, very creative and people, and freedom loving people. But now it's being used against us, and it's become a something detrimental to us that we need to understand. And really, the answer is to say, for us to be able to say what's good for white people. We've got to get white people to be able to say what's good for white people, because I don't think that telling people that they shouldn't think about what's good for them is the answer. I don't believe that. I don't care if the Jews think about what's good for them, but the rest of us need to think about what's good for us and not be so naive. They're better at it. They're clever. They're very clever. So we might always be a step or two behind, but there's a lot more of us.
Yes, we won't have much success trying to tell them not to be ethnocentric and not care about their own needs. In fact, that we would be accused of aggressing against them if we did. And I think that that's how we should interpret their attempts to stifle our telling of our things from our point of view and what's good for us, is that it's aggression against us, basically. We've let a lot of it happen on the sly without being aware of it. But
speaking of Rodney, Rodney homeschools his three children. He is able to do it. He has a little more free time than you do. And he does that along with his wife. And that's great. And that's one way to keep them. But, you know, if you teach your children, if you're close to your children and you talk to them, and then they're prepared anyway for what they run into in school. But, you know, how does this son of yours deal with that, and your older sons? How do they deal? I mean, even your daughter, how just stay quiet? Do they speak their mind a little bit, or what? because the school curriculum is really terrible. It's extreme.
Well, I've urged them to speak out. I have a taste of homeschooling myself, because we did in our final years in California. We homeschooled for a while, but then we moved specifically to find a better place, better schools, nicer neighborhoods, safer places to live. And we found a very nice place. And so the schools here, just one example, there's not as much of this taboo about mixing prayer or Christian Christianness or Christianity, because most of the people here, the American, the old stock American population is still fairly intact where we are. So this one Jew is kind of crypto. He's very low key. This one teacher, he's an okay guy. You know, I've met him. He's smart and so forth. And he's not a real activist, but you see his Jewishness and his Jewish identity squirts out in his teaching. And this is why the National Socialists, among other things, didn't want Jews teaching their children. And Rodney's approach, I think, is for the people who can do it, who have the resources, and even I would encourage people to give it a try, because you yourself as a parent will learn just how poisonous the message is that your kids are getting. When we took control and did homeschooling, it was supervised by the school. So, you know, basically they gave us the lesson plans, and we still worked with materials they did. We supplemented the materials with things that we wanted to add as well. But we saw some of this poisonous stuff. And for instance, in the teaching of science in middle school, they boost minorities and women. Any contribution that any minority has ever made is put front and center and celebrated. Because the reality of Western science is it's one white man after another doing this and that. And they can't really avoid that when they get into the meat and potatoes of it. But certainly on the cover, there'll be a picture of a diversity on the cover. And, you know, all through the introduction to every chapter is some celebration of diversity. And having your own kid there, the parents learn about it and become more conscious of it, although it's a chicken and egg problem, is you need parents who are sort of conscious of why they're homeschooling, why they're going through the pain of homeschooling their kid, to realize in the first place. So it's sort of preaching to the Pope. You know, you're already converted by the time you're doing the homeschooling. But it still was eye-opening even for us, even after we decided to do homeschooling to protect our kids from the drugs and violence and the mestizo kids that fill most of Southern California schools these days. We also found out then about the anti-white ideological poisoning that they're fed.
It is. It probably is worse than we realize. I know the last it was a few years back that I did my last teaching what do you call that? Can't even think what it's called. Substitute teacher. And whenever I did any substitute teaching, I would get into grade school sometimes, and I was shocked then at the kind of things that went on. And I wasn't as far advanced in my understanding as I am now, but it's sick, really. It's ridiculous. It's not even truthful. It's not historical. It doesn't paint a real picture, a picture of reality at all.
Yes, the schools are definitely part of our problem.
And I also saw these young fourth grade boys were so cowed. They were the smart ones, you know, and they were so cowed to show to be better than these other kids who were not, these non-white children in the class. And they had been so indoctrinated to be polite and to see everybody as equal that they could hardly even do what they were doing. I used to encourage them to when I was there for my 1 or 2 days or something, you know, but it was painful. It's painful to watch what goes on and what's being done to our people.
That aspect of what the Jews complain about, this scapegoating and stereotyping and saying negative things about groups of people, that is, there's validity there. And we see it with white people. The problem that I have with the Jews is that all they care about is the Jews. And if anybody says anything bad about the Jews, you know, they've got to lose their job immediately. But negative, horrible things are said about white people all the time. It's taught in our schools. This narrative of whites being guilty of this litany of sins that, you know, we stole the land, we enslaved the blacks, we gassed the Jews. It's not taught literally that blatantly, but it's, you can tell from when the kids themselves describe, you know, I don't know, some of these interviews with university kids during Black History Month, they come up with the craziest nonsense that that they distill what they're taught in the schools and what they see on the television and what they see in the newspapers. They distill it down. And what you hear them, how they describe it, is I think, what the intent is, which is to make white people feel really bad, to make us feel really guilty, and to self-advocate.
To make us step aside for
exactly,
the others.
Exactly.
Step
the whole
aside.
Idea is,
yeah.
That's the Jewish guilt trip, is your people have oppressed my people for, you know, forever, and you should feel guilty about that. Just shut up and give me what I want.
Well, you know, the fact is we've helped the whole world. I mean, everybody's is indebted to the white race, really. And that's, I've heard people, Ray Goodwin makes a good case of that. When he was teaching, he has some good examples of things he said. He can really put things straight. And, he doesn't beat around the bush at all, but he's polite about it. And he's made that point. He said he made that to his classes, and they really stood back and took it in because they realized he was right. He would say things like, he'd turn off the light switch in the room, and then
turn
it back on again. Did you hear him say that?
Yes.
And then he said, white people made this light possible, and he did a bunch of other things. And, you know, this is all true. So this hate narrative, you know, they, what bothers me a lot now is the way they're on the warpath all the time. Jews, they're attacking everyone, everything. Every time somebody says boo, you know, they're jumping on the bandwagon. From my perspective, it's like, you idiot fools, you know, who would listen to you? But they must be having some kind of an effect, or they wouldn't keep doing it.
Well, Kevin MacDonald calls that the full court press. It's like the Jews are just, they never give an inch on anything. They're constantly pressing.
There you go.
Even this issue about Dresden, the bombings in Germany, I could see it on the Wikipedia pages, on the talk section behind the page. You know, you can read the page itself, but then behind the page is the discussion about what's been added, what's been taken out, and why. And you can see basically a war going on there between the people who adhere, and the Jewish narrative wins ultimately. And there's even recognition, an explicit recognition, that point of view is something that needs to be compensated for. You know, you should be writing these articles in an encyclopedic form for their information, and not having a point of view, pro or con, one side or the other. And you see basically the struggle that the Jewish advocates, the people who's, and it's not always probably even 100% Jews. It's just people whose heads are full of the Jewish narrative, that we've got to present the narrative or our page in a certain way. Anything else is apology for the, it's minimizing the crime against humanity of the Nazis. And on the bombing of Dresden page, for instance, they had linked earlier today, it's not there anymore, but they had linked a page called Historical Revisionism and then Negationism in parentheses. And because they were talking about this whole idea of celebrating, memorializing Dresden as a way of basically, minimizing the crimes against humanity. That's what this page, this
sure.
Negationism page gets into. And even the narrative about the narratives is dominated by Jews and people with the Jewish narrative in their head fighting tooth and nail, as if it's an existential struggle for them. And I take my cue from them. I think it is an existential struggle. I think what the Jews realize is if they lose control to the point where their narrative can be subordinated to some other narrative, as it was in National Socialist Germany, then bad things are going to happen to them. The problem for us is, at the moment, our narrative is the one that's being suppressed and repressed and subordinated to the Jewish narrative. And that is poisonous for us. It's deadly for us. I think it is enabling a genocide of our kind.
Well, exactly. That's what they're afraid to lose one to lose an inch. You know, they can't lose an inch in their in their thinking, or they might then lose more. I mean, the whole thing might come unraveled, and then where they're going to be. And that's why they're so aggressive and so kind of ridiculous in the stuff they go after, which
it is
really,
to the point of
sometimes
ridiculous.
It makes them look bad to a lot of people. So why is this Jew, you know, screaming around about this, you know, who does he think he is?
Because they can.
There's
another aspect to it that I only sort of stumbled on today or realized today, which is that they want all the discussion to be the Jewish narrative and their point of view. They essentially want to suck the air out of anybody else getting a say. They don't want anybody else to get their point of view expressed. That itself, that even in an objective sense, you know, a sort of moral equivalence.
That's why you can't debate with them. They won't. They won't debate things. They don't want to debate. They don't want to hear the other side.
Correct.
They want to criminalize the other side.
And that's the part in my post about the Jewish narrative, the white guide, was about the hate narrative and how they will call the other side haters, right? You're stupid, crazy, evil haters. And the reason for that, I think, is because of this never give an inch mentality of they cannot even just talk about it objectively as a conflict of interest between two different groups, you know, the Jews and whoever else, because that would be too objective. That would let the camel's nose in the tent of saying, well, then, you know, when there's a conflict, maybe it's also partly the Jews' fault. Their story is that they've been horribly oppressed, and it's not even their fault. You know, they didn't do anything wrong. It's entirely the other people. And so it has to be some irrational hate that causes this, because if it was just, say, a conflict between groups, that would mean that Jews are responsible for some part of it. And they can't even accept that. It's part of that whole full press mentality of theirs, this existential thing. They've got to be on top.
Well, that's right. That's right. You know, it's very difficult because our people think that I know a lot of they're supposed to be our people. They're people on the internet, so I don't really know who they are. But they say they're our people, and they believe that we're going to work out some arrangement with the Jews eventually, you know, that we're going to we're going to convince, they're going to come to see some reasoning when they quit being so afraid or this or that, that if we could just get some open debate, if we need some more free speech, they really think that we can come to some. I don't think so. My feeling has been for quite a while that we have to be separate.
Yes,
because I don't
separation.
Know. You know, maybe after 200 years of separation of what was this, Solzhenitsyn's 200 years of being together, 200 or 400 years of separation. Well, maybe people would change some and wouldn't have to be separated anymore.
Yeah.
But as it goes now, there is no way that they are going, that they have, it's just what you've been saying. There's no way that they want to go halfway. They're not going halfway with anything. And I don't want to go halfway with them either. Really.
Right. Well, you would think it would be simple then. We could just go our own ways, right? Here's a conundrum. They call us crazy, stupid, evil haters, you horrible anti-Semites. You can't run away from us. You can't keep us out of your country.
I love that one. That's what they had. They're furious about that. About that. When I say that, I'm sure if any of them are listening, they really hate me. That's the last thing they want to hear anybody say, that we need to get rid of these Jews and put them, not kill them, not exterminate them, but put them somewhere where they can't do what they're doing to us.
Carolyn, I would go further. It marks me as a weak person who won't argue 100% for my people, but I would be willing to move away. I would be willing to take over some uninhabited island somewhere and move away from them, not even deport them from us. And they still wouldn't even be able to tolerate that. We couldn't set up our own country from scratch. If we moved to the moon, like the name Tanstoffel comes from a novel having to do with the moon self-determination, a moon colony going off on its own, they wouldn't even allow that.
Because they can't live among themselves. I would love to see it.
Right.
They have to live off us, off other people, and they have to be productive people like the white Europeans are. They can't live off the Africans or something like that. So, I would love to see the Jews all put together like the Nazis wanted to do, like put them all on Madagascar or something. You know, I have said before that in no time they would eat each other up. They would destroy each other if they only had one another to prey on.
Yeah.
I mean,
I haven't paid too much attention to it, but there's the goings on in Israel. But that is this general sentiment I get from a lot of Israelis. I mean, there's many of them that are nationalists, and they're very happy to be amongst them.
Here we are, Tan Steffel. I want to thank you, and I want to repeat your website. It's Age of Treason with a hyphen in between, .blogspot.com. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.